Hello, my name is Susan Piver. I'm very happy to make this short talk for you on the fourth step on the Noble Eightfold Path, Right Action. And then we'll conclude with a short 10-minute guided meditation. So please take your seat, get settled. If you're planning to practice, you can sit on a cushion on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, or you can sit in a chair. With your feet flat on the floor. And remember, chair is equally as spiritual as the floor. So however you choose to sit is fine. So this, as I mentioned, is the fourth video in an 8-video series on the Noble Eightfold Path. Just to recap very briefly, the Noble Eightfold Path is also called the Fourth Noble Truth. So if you like numbers, you're in really good shape. The Four Noble Truths are the very first teachings that the Buddha gave upon his attainment of enlightenment more than 2,500 years ago. He practiced all the practices of his day, extreme ascetic practices, deep yogic practices, all the practices, and they were very helpful, but he was still not quite liberated from suffering, which is the point of all our spiritual practices. So at one point he just sat down underneath a tree, now called the Bodhi tree. Bodhi means awake, and basically said to himself, I'm just going to sit here in meditation until I am liberated. And according to different stories, it was this many days or that many days. Suffice to say, it was some days. And his meditative concentration was so consistent, so flexible, that he was always able, I imagine, to come back to the still point, that in a certain period of time, even though many obstacles were presented in the form of what are called maras, M-A-R-A-S, forces that tried to disrupt his meditative equanimity, nonetheless, he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And went back to join his spiritual community and said, I suppose I have attained enlightenment, although I probably didn't need to say that. People noticed, and what's up? He said, four things are up. First thing, life is suffering, first noble truth, which doesn't mean life sucks. Let me just be very clear about that. That is not the first noble truth. That would be terrible. It means something like, life is unsatisfying, because we never quite get to where we want to get. And if we do, because there certainly are moments where we accomplish fantastic things, eventually that fantastic thing will itself dissolve. So there's nothing to hold on to. Don't ask me who designed this system, because I don't know. The second noble truth is called the cause of suffering, which says, well, pretending the first noble truth isn't true is actually the cause of suffering. So it's not the dissatisfaction or the impermanence themselves that cause suffering, which I think is very interesting and important to note. Rather, it's that we fight that. We try to make things permanent. We try to hold on to the things that we value, which is quite understandable. And we try to push away the things we don't want, also understandable. But all of that ignores that there's a natural ebb and flow that is in every moment, in every cell, in every experience, and there's nothing that arises that will not also dissolve. The second noble truth says grasping is the cause of suffering, which is basically pretending the first noble truth isn't true or fighting it. I do like to make sure I've turned on the mic. The third noble truth is called the cessation of suffering. So now we're getting to the good news, which says now that you know the cause, grasping, you know the cure. Just stop doing that. Okay, cool. I will entertain that notion. How do you just do that? Well, fourth noble truth, there are 8 things that you can do. Eightfold Path, it's called. The first video, which was now, I can't remember how many weeks ago, 8, covered right view. You don't have to go back and listen to those, although there'll be links here if you would like to. It all begins with the right view, which is seeing the truth of impermanence. And where it gets tricky, at least for myself, is That seeing itself is impermanent. Sometimes I see it, sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's clear, sometimes I lose it. Okay, still the right view does not change what the right view is. Seeing things clearly, which weirdly means, don't ask me to explain this because I can't, because I don't understand it myself. Basically, it means awareness of what is without a reference point. Okay, perhaps fodder for another conversation. The second noble truth is called right intention, which naturally arises from the right view. When you see things clearly, you want to do what will bring benefit. So it's naturally there. The third step on the Noble Eightfold Path, which we talked about last time, 2 weeks ago, right speech, my favorite. So right view gives rise to right intention, which leads to right speech. Using your communication, your voice, but not just the words you say, but your presence to communicate well, which doesn't mean always sweet and nice. Sometimes right speech is loud or cutting. Sometimes right speech is silent. But the only way you know is to hold the right view and hold the right intention, and then you naturally know, according to this system. Right view plus right intention plus right speech, the ability to communicate and show up with kindness and wisdom, equal the fourth step on the Noble Eightfold Path, right action. That the things you do are right, which means something like bring more compassion to the situation, appropriate, relevant, truthful, genuine, meaningful, right. So what's right can change from moment to moment. I'm sure that doesn't need explaining. So in the traditional Buddhist view, right action is sometimes described as what doing what you need to do, or in this case, probably not do, to cut the karmic chain. Because in the Buddhist view, everything we do creates a consequence. Everything we do is a cause that results in an effect. So if we, you know, it can be as simple as if we think kind thoughts, we will see the world through a lens of kindness, perhaps. If we walk out angry into our day, we will find someone or something to be angry about. So everything, every cause has an effect. Buddhism is very much about the truth of karma. It is true, what goes around comes around. However, also according to this view, your karma is carried forward through countless lifetimes. So what is happening, you know, I'm making this part up, but what is happening for you in your life right now may not necessarily be the karma of what you did yesterday or 18 years ago, but maybe 18 lifetimes ago. So we can't see the karmic chain, which is weird. And for me, also kind of heartening, like, oh, I don't have to be so, it's not all completely in my control. Actually, it's not. What is in my control is my view, my intention, my speech, and my action. So here's a weird little personal story that comes to me to tell. I don't know why. A long time ago, like 25 years ago, I was in a really bad accident. Anyone who's been in the Open Heart Project for a while has probably heard me talk about this. It was a bad accident, my friends. Talking about nobody expected me to live. Talking about I don't remember it. I don't remember it. I have no memory of it at all. I was driving along in my sweet 67 Volkswagen Beetle, which is basically like a tin can, and I was T-boned by a drunk driver who ran a red light, and I flew out the passenger door and landed on some grass 30 yards away. I know this because I read it in the police report. I don't actually remember it, which is a weird thing. It's like they could have told me, oh, you were kidnapped by aliens. Oh, no. I just know because I was told what happened, which creates a strange sense of unreality. And anyway, not the point. Why did that happen? I don't know. I don't know. If I start examining that for like, what did I F up that made this happen to me? I don't know. Or maybe I killed someone in a vehicle in a past life, and this is payback. Maybe. I don't know. All I know is, and I don't even know, it happened. I know because I have all the evidence in my, on my, imprinted on my body. Anyway, the main injury that I had was called a liver fracture, which means my liver was lacerated. And this is gross. Fast forward. I understand there's two kinds of people in the world, people that like gory details of injuries and people that really don't. So that means it was a bad injury because you can't live without that organ and you can't stop it from bleeding usually once it starts to bleed because it doesn't respond to suturing. In any case, I did. I did respond to it. I lived. And but it was a, you know, it's like an 80% more mortality for an injury like that. Oh, okay. Liver. So great. I got a lot of blood transfusions. I'm making this story way longer than I intended. And I lived. And it turns out I also got hepatitis C, which I don't have anymore, from blood transfusions. So that was a liver illness, unrelated to a liver injury, but they both happened at the same time. That's weird. So I'm like, I have some karma around that organ. This was like a 1-2 massive punch. So I did, some years later, I was doing okay, but I'm like, okay, I got to do the treatment. I did it about 10 years ago. And it's a hard, hard treatment. Then it was very hard. A year of very heavy medications and flu-like symptoms and so forth. It was brutal. And I cleared the virus during the treatment, but then I did not sustain the cure. I relapsed 3 months after the treatment concluded. Uh-oh. So there's a treatment had a 50-50 chance of working, but there's a treatment for relapsers. Oh my God, I'm making this so long. I'm sorry. The treatment for relapsers or non-responders had a 35% success rate. I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I don't know why I get it. I'm doing it. It's another year of twice as much medication, twice as many symptoms, side effects, but I want to do this to pacify that karma for whoever's going to be me next. It really was not very mature spiritual thinking. Nonetheless, I had this sense that I was given this situation or caused this situation according to the laws of karma. And now I had a chance to complete it. I didn't know if I was going to heal or not. But something here is saying, do this. So I did, and I was cured. It might not have turned out that way, but it happened to have been successful, and that was, like I say, 10 years ago. So thank you, Western medicine and allopathic treatments. But there's some sense that I don't know where this came from, but now it's mine. Let me heal it for whatever or whoever comes next. So the right action in this case, and I apologize again for going on about this, is take what's given to you. Don't accept it and be a doormat and like any of those things. How do I heal it? How do I work with it? For my own benefit and for the benefit of others and for the benefit of future manifestations of my energy, which I don't even know what the F that means, but I think it's true anyway. What can I do right now? So, cutting the karmic links, That's one very personal way of explaining it. But another more general way of explaining, how can I take actions? If all actions cause consequences, how can I take actions that not only create good karma, but actually cut the karmic chain? Because that's where liberation lives, in the absence of karma. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But that is a really good question to contemplate. And it has something to do with bringing awareness to each moment, fully, and then letting go. Fully, awareness, letting go, awareness, letting go. Letting things be as they are, with full feeling. So it doesn't mean not feeling things or being like, oh, everything's okay, therefore I am exempt from suffering, because you're not. Noticing and being with things as they are is what leads to the cessation of karma. So there's a chant I do every morning that has a stanza that goes, awareness is the body of meditation to this meditator who rests simply without altering it. Grant your blessing so that my meditation is free from conception. So to me, I've been saying that every morning for probably 25 years. That has something to do with right action. This meditator who rests simply without altering it. Another way of looking at right action is to take the five precepts, as it were, as they're called, every day. Don't do these things. These are wrong action. They're going to sound very obvious. No killing, no lying, no stealing, no abuse of substances, and no inappropriate sexual behavior. So those are sort of the baseline. And they're not that simple. You're not a killer, I'm pretty sure. You're not a liar, although we all lie. And we all have some relationship to snuffing out something, whether it's a bug or you did it on purpose or you did it by accident. But here it's like, don't do those things. Don't do those things. And these are good things to remind yourself of every day. Not as a shaming thing, but like, today I will take the precepts again. I will not kill. I will not steal. I will not lie, etc. Recommit every day. That's a great thing to add to your practice. So the rightest right action is to work with awareness, as I mentioned earlier, and let your awareness rest on what is actually happening. That's a tall order, but you can do it because you know how to meditate. So I truly hope this is useful. I guess the last thing I'll say is the ability to work skillfully with awareness has something to do with the ability to be skillfully non-attached. Now, that's a very tricky notion. I've been in situations where I get upset about something, or because I got a lot of emotions like a normal person, and they're like, well, why are you so attached? I'm like, because I'm a normal person. But usually when people say, why are you so attached, they mean something like, I don't want you to feel that. So I'm going to shame you a little bit, or a lot, and question your spiritual rectitude or whatever. Thanks. Not helpful. And also not what is meant by attachment. Of course, you and I are attached to things. We're attached to people we love. We're attached to the things we dream of. We're attached to comfort and ease, and they're not fine. Fine. Where attachment becomes a problem, or the first place to look, perhaps, is why are you attached to non-attachment? That's the first attachment to examine. Because if you go into every situation saying, I'm not going to be attached, that's bad. Well, that's an attachment. So instead of saying that, instead of giving yourself this rule to abide by, Awareness wants to flow with what is. And when you feel, oh, I'm very attached here, cool. Don't try to stop that, because that itself is an expression of attachment. Rather, bring your awareness to what it feels like to be attached to a desired outcome or an outcome you desire to avert. That's the place to start. Awareness is the right action, always. Bring it to what is. So, I hope this is useful. Next video will be about right livelihood. So as you, maybe you can see, all the rights build on each other. So when we have the right view, the right intention, are capable of right speech, have a connection to right action, then what we do in our life for work is built on a solid foundation. So thank you. I look for that video in 2 weeks. And now let's practice together. Begin your practice, please, by forgetting about everything I just said. Just let it all settle. Imagine that the words and your responses and the thoughts you might be having are like snowflakes in a snow globe. And when you listen to someone talk, the snow globe kind of shakes because we're paying attention and having responses. But in meditation, let there be a sense that you put the snow globe down and you don't have to try to get the snowflakes to settle. They just do on their own. So no effort is necessary. Establish your posture. Sit up straight. And feel that as you take even a slightly uplifted posture relative to how you might have been sitting, there's a sense of dignity that comes to the fore. Not afraid to be who you are right now. That's dignity. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And the hands are really resting. They're not working. They're relaxing. You guys, you got a big day ahead of you? Just take a break. You can just relax. Let yourself feel heavy from the waist down, rooted, firm, immovable, right in the middle of your life. And let yourself feel light from the waist up, open, curious, responsive, alive. Let the belly relax. And when you think it's relaxed, relax it a little bit more. We can hold a lot in the lower abdomen. So really let there be a sense of spreading, relaxing. And imagine that this spreading would continue even when you take your attention off of it, unless that feels weird, in which case, don't do it. Let the shoulders relax. I often have a sense, even in my meditation, that I'm pulling forward trying to get somewhere. If you have any such sense, let that go and even sit back a little bit. Let your back body rest back with this even sense. I'm not leaning into the past or trying to shy away, and I'm not pulling forward into what may come. I'm in the middle. I'm right here. Same time you're just sitting there. So no big deal. The mouth is closed. Let the muscles of speech relax, the jaw, the throat, the tongue. You don't need them right now because you don't have to say anything, which is luxurious. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, meaning there's no breathing technique, just you breathing as you have since the moment you were born. Keep doing that. The eyes remain open, and the gaze is cast down to a spot in front, up to 6 feet or 2.5 meters, depending on the distance of your screen. And let the gaze be soft, like it's resting on a spot, not gripping a spot. And we sit with our eyes open because we're practicing being awake. When we're awake, we can have right view. When we're awake, we can sense right intention, certainly right speech and right action. So this practice is a support for the Noble Eightfold Path. It's the very foundation, actually. Let the brow relax. Let your attention rest on the breath, which means feel the breath, not notice the breath. There's a subtle difference between noticing and feeling. Feeling is more like being with. Noticing is like stepping away to observe. Feeling's the opposite, it's stepping further in to experience. So experience the inhale. It's very ordinary. You've been doing it your whole life. Experience the exhale, the letting go. There's a tiny gap at the end of the exhale, a little rest, musically speaking, and then the next inhale just happens. It's natural. It's effortless. You don't have to try. So it's a perfect vehicle to carry our awareness in a state of rest, feeling the inhale, the exhale. The mind loves to rest on the breath, it turns out. Your mind will continue to produce thoughts, that's fine. No effort to change that. Just let them come and go. And if you notice that you've become absorbed in thought to the point where you have forgotten about your breath, you're no longer present to your breath, cool. Notice that. Label that thinking. Let go. Just let go. Gently come back to the breath. And begin again with this inhale, this exhale. I'm doing the same thing, and we'll sit together for a little while. Thank you so much for your practice. It's important. It's awesome. Thank you for practicing with me. I feel it, and I'm really grateful. And thank you for practicing together. Somehow, almost 20,000 people are getting these videos. So whenever or wherever you're practicing, somebody is practicing with you. And it's this invisible link of incredibly beautiful human beings such as yourself seeking something true in this life. So, see you in a few weeks.